Blog Talk Radio.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Greetings, everybody. This is Karina for the With Intent Show on the Coach on Fire Radio Network. Today, we're going to be discussing suicide. And the reason we're discussing suicide is because December is really a month of increased suicide around the world, not only here in South Africa.
This is quite personal to me because according to some research done or data on a News 24 article, South Africa is the eighth highest suicide ranking in the world. As well as one person dies from suicide every 40 seconds in the world, and it's more common in males than in females. So suicide is a prevalent challenge within the world today.
People are feeling dark, desolate, very lonely, while the world around them is having laughing, joking, and having a lot of family time. And sometimes the only route out is to end it all. I'm going to be chatting to Brendan Richardson, who's experienced this firsthand, as well as experiencing self-cutting from a very young age. But he turned his life around. So that's a very cool interview. You need to come listen to that one. If you do want to call in, our number is 646-716-7979. If you'd like more information on the show, please visit our website at www.withintent.co.za. We have very cool motivational videos. Those are our very own motivational videos, as well as self-development assessments. So go through and check our website out. The other day I was driving through a town and I saw a headline saying, father kills his two children, his wife and himself. What makes somebody want to do that? How desperate are you, or how dark is your world to do something like that? Listen through and we will chat and discuss this a bit further. I'd like to just read a quote from Rumi, or a poem, and this probably describes suicide in a very real form. He says, keep walking, though there's no place to get to. Don't try to see through the distances. That's not for human beings. Move within, but don't move the way fear makes you move. Walk to the well, turn as the earth and the moon turns, circling what they love. Whatever circles comes from the center. And probably this is one way of describing suicide, is the total, there is fear, darkness, desolation. And as Rumi says, move away from it. Don't move towards it. And look within, where you'll find help, as well as look without, where you will find assistance, if you have the courage to ask. So I'm going to, let's listen to Brendan and take it from there. Okay, Brendan, you're on.
Maybe we should start with, hello, Brendan, how are you today?
Fine and you.
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure.
So, as I was saying, I'm doing this show on suicide, and I know that you used to cut.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking in some way they're related, but perhaps you can just tell me a bit about it.
Yeah, I think from my experience, I mean, I was suicidal in different periods of my life, predominantly in my teens, and then again later into my late 20s. They kind of did... Cutting did something very different for me as opposed to the suicidal intentions, which was I found out by cutting purely by accident. I was probably about 13, 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I had been through a couple of traumas, which it was abuse. But I, at that stage, I blocked it out. So I wasn't mm-hmm. aware that it had been. It only came to me 20 years later.
Okay.
But, you know, when you're at school and boys being, and as I say, I'll only talk from my experience, but boys being boys, you know, you play around with compasses and things at school and knives and what mm-hmm. have you. And it was really one day I was in my room and using a compass with the blood releasing, I felt a release of pain. And that's, you know, that really stood out for me. And that's where my cutting on a regular basis started. I was obviously emotionally in a lot of turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very, you know, I was a very angry teenager. I gave my parents absolute hell. I didn't listen. I didn't, you know, I fought all the time. And as I say, I didn't really know what the cause of it was, but the act of cutting, and for me it was more about seeing the blood
mm-hmm.
than anything else,
okay.
is that when that blood broke the skin, I just felt incredible relief, and I felt like my pain, and that would dissipate
okay.
For short periods of time. So I cut in places that people wouldn't see.
Mm-hmm.
I hid it very well. I mean, my parents never knew until I was 36 years old that I
wow.
used to cut. So that's the extent that I hid it, and I did it on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I hid it under shirts and I hid it under kind of that stuff. Whereas suicide, when I went through my suicidal patches, again, it was something that I never. Something I did on my own, and I certainly didn't alert anybody to the fact that I was doing it. I had a couple of failed suicide attempts. One was medication, and my parents weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to, I don't know when later, obviously feeling very ill.
Mm-hmm.
Quite angry that I was alive,
okay.
Still. And then I didn't do it for a while again, but, you know, I had a lot of what we call suicidal ideation, thinking about it, thinking how I would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And although I didn't always act on it, it occupied my mind day in, day out, constantly.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like it was my escape. And I kind of, you know, the cutting, so it was related because it was kind of the relief of the pain, but it certainly, I wasn't going to cut to kill myself.
Yes.
The ways that I would do it were something completely different. And as I say, it kind of returned later in my 20s. I got into drugs and alcohol. I stopped cutting when I first started drinking heavily. And,
okay.
and the cutting went away.
Okay. So was it
like almost? It was a switch of
coping
mechanisms. Mm. However, I am a recovering addict and alcoholic. When the drugs and the alcohol turned on me again and I couldn't deal with the pain and the coping mechanisms wasn't working, the cutting came back.
Okay.
So then I was drinking, using, and I was cutting.
Mm.
And then the suicide
came back
again as well. And even now I've been in recovery for a number of years. And although I've been given a lot of tools, I do suffer from depression. I diagnosed depression from way before I started using. I have to manage those thoughts because they do
okay.
come back.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about managing them now. And I can get through and I know it'll go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's more important than anything because initially back then, I never thought that would go away. I thought my only route was to die. And that's kind of, so that's kind of the difference for me of cutting was a relief and suicide was a way out. and so they kind of worked hand in hand. But mm. you know.
So what would trigger it? Was there a trigger that actually, because you did say you did cutting and then you also did suicide, but it was like in patches. So was there a trigger? Maybe, but obviously you were unaware of it because of what had happened.
I think it was a multitude of triggers. You know, not having the coping mechanisms to deal with it, not understanding what was going on with me. I didn't talk about my stuff, and I think that's a big part of it. I never went into therapy. I never opened myself up to. I thought there was something wrong with me, the way I would think.
Okay.
And I was very frightened of that and of people knowing
okay, that there was shame. Some,
exactly, very based around shame.
Mm.
And sorry, I lose my train of thought sometimes. But yeah, so I think really it would be a buildup of stuff, not getting anything out, not dealing with it, not coping with it. Mm. Obviously, because I was such an angry kid, I would create more of my own problems. Which I blamed on everybody else, obviously.
Because
it was never my fault, it was everybody else's fault. And then it would get to that point where the cutting wasn't working anymore. If I was drinking or using drugs, that wasn't working anymore. And suicide became the option. And then often an attempt, and I think I had about 3 or 4 serious attempts. Then it would go away for a while. I would be quite frightened of
actually dying.
Of what I'd done.
Okay.
Although, you know, and this is the complexity of it, and at the same time I'd be quite angry that it hadn't worked. it was this constant conflict within myself and not dealing with it. Eventually when I did go see therapists and that, I still never talked about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, all of this really only came out for me after, when I went into rehab after a couple of times, when I found out about the abuse, when I got put into situations where I had to confront what was going on with me. Otherwise, I don't know if I ever would have. And in one way, I think, you know, the rehab was my saving grace for all of the other things that had happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you think that it was the abuse that triggered everything? Obviously, or because the way I'm seeing it, I'm just, your anger was probably because of the unconscious abuse.
Mm. I always felt very lost as a child.
Mm.
That was always there. I always felt like I didn't fit in. I didn't, you know, that I always remember. My mom actually told me that I used to tell her at 2 years old, between 2 and 3, when I could just talk, that I used to tell her that I don't belong here, which is quite an absurd thing for a 2 or 3. But I used to say it repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up feeling like I don't belong.
Mm.
So I think that the abuse certainly had a lot to do with it. But I think that period of puberty, I was bullied through school as well.
Mm.
All of that kind of just, it became this mountain of stuff that I was unable to cope with. Mm. And that was my fears always. Was that, you know, nobody likes me, I don't like myself, which wasn't the truth always. I think the abuse had a big part to play with it, certainly.
Because you had the shame and the guilt and all that related to the abuse.
Yeah, yeah.
And you didn't know about it.
No.
So just out of interest, would you look at yourself in the mirror?
It's an interesting question because I think, and again, my addiction and my recovery comes into playing a big part of all of that, because when I eventually came into recovery and I actually found recovery, I remember the day very clearly. And it was about a year and a half of into recovery and a lot of introspection and a lot of dealing with all of this kind of stuff. And I remember looking in the mirror and for the first time ever seeing myself.
Oh.
For the first, and sorry, it's quite emotional because I'd looked in mirrors, do your hair, you brush your teeth, I'd looked in mirrors, but that was the first time I ever looked into my own eyes and saw me there and could say that I liked myself. I just certainly didn't love myself at that stage. I don't even know if I'm there yet. But the transition was huge. So to answer that question, I don't think I ever had. I remember, especially when I was drinking and using and in those periods, I would demonize myself in the mirror. And I would look into myself and tell myself how much I hated myself and what a monster I was. So that moment of seeing myself, to me, probably was the first time. It was massive. The first time I saw myself and went, I'm okay with you. And as I say, that day will stick in my mind for as long as I live. It was a very clear moment.
So what was the turning point? What was the turning point when you decided, you know what, it's over now, I need to go into rehab? What happened?
I never chose to go into rehab. I went into rehab the first time because to make family happy. I was tired of the pain and maybe it was a bit of a break from all of that. And I manipulated that a lot. I was terrified of introspection, of taking a look at myself. I didn't like what I thought was there. And the last time that I went into rehab, it was really, I think, I'd done this over and over and over again. There had been more suicide attempts, and my mom was witness to one. So things had gotten a lot worse. And my father gave me an ultimatum, and he said that he would be prepared to support me one more time, but it would be under his conditions and not mine. I used to decide when I was leaving rehab, and I would make those decisions for myself. And pretty much, he said, I'll leave when he says I'm ready, which was obviously would be based on what the counselors and that said. And it was in that period, and I think it was 4 months of where I did the same thing, where I manipulated. I knew how recovery worked, and so I could say all the right things. I could make it look like I was doing all of the right things, and it got incredibly painful because I didn't have the coping mechanisms. I couldn't cut, I couldn't drink, I couldn't use, and I wasn't getting better. And it became, and again, that's another day that I remember where I couldn't live like that anymore. And I said, I actually asked for help. I don't know who I asked it to. I remember I was sitting outside and I just burst into tears and I just said, I can't do this anymore. Nothing changed instantly, but that was certainly the turning point where I started doing things properly for myself. And I faced my fears and I talked about my fears.
That was also huge.
Massive. And I listened to other people as well for the first time because I found that I wasn't alone, that I wasn't the only one who had those thoughts, those ideas, that hated myself. To that degree, there was a lot of us out there, and by having other people working through it at the same time as me, it helped me to have the courage to keep moving forward. And when very often all I wanted to do was run and kind of go back, but that support, the right therapists, my one therapist, she certainly changed everything for me, because the way she dealt with me was as a human being and with love and compassion. I wasn't a bad addict. I was a human being who was suffering. Exactly. And my experiences previous had been that you're shameful and you need to stop and look what you're doing to everybody else. She took the approach of look what you're doing to yourself and and that changed everything for me. That somebody dealt with me in that way. And that's where it all stemmed from. And I'm grateful that through that I've managed to so far maintain and work through everything.
Wow.
There's still a lot of stuff that's very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I get teary. Even now I get teary talking about things and that. But it's kind of a good teary. It's not a shameful. It's seeing how far I've come. And that I can live.
You can live. And will anything drive you to go back?
I think that's difficult to say, because I need to, like I said, I have times where my depression kicks in and the thoughts come back. I challenge them now. I certainly am able to, at the moment, deal with them appropriately. That could change in terms of if I decide not to do that anymore. Do you know what I mean? If I just step back and become complacent, I certainly believe that I could end up going back that route again. If I picked up drugs and alcohol again, I can almost guarantee I would end up in that suicidal, probably worse than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, it's about, being aware that those thoughts are there. Being aware when they get stronger. I can't do anything to change those thoughts coming, but I can challenge them and I can use, the tools that I have to the people around me. I can talk. If I start isolating, I've got big problems, you know what I mean? Then I see myself going down. And it's really about talking and connecting and with people who understand, more importantly than anything.
So the connection is very important.
Hugely. And it's something I resist. it's an effort. It's a huge effort to make that connection. But it's vital. That connection is what saves me every time, and being honest about it.
Because as suicidal and as an addict, you've got those manipulations and the dishonesty and the lying to yourself.
Constantly. So yeah, and it's very easy to fall into that pattern. And I've got to be vigilant that the most of that comes through having having friends in recovery, having, I belong to a 12-step group, but having a sponsor, people I trust. And then I'm okay. So it can be hard at times. But I think the most important thing is that I know it'll come to an end.
Eventually,
see what it is for what it is. This is not going to be something there forever. Otherwise, it's quite easy to pack it in and say, I can't do this.
But you've got also the support of family and that kind of thing. I just want to see if there's anything else I want to talk about. But you've got the support of the family. And what have you done since you've been in recovery? Hey, well, how's your life changed?
Oh, my life is radically different. I'm very lucky. I do have support of my family, especially my wife. She can see when things are starting to change for me. So she'll sometimes help make me aware of it. It's not a case of just snap out of it. That doesn't happen anymore. So that support is amazing. And sometimes I have to go down for a day or two before I can pull myself right back up, and she's there. What I've done in recovery is I used to work in advertising and in the film industry, and my life was very much about parties, career, a lot of external stuff. I've changed that around completely. I'm now a counselor. I run a treatment center. I help other people. And that I realized was one of the things I had to do. It was never something again that I particularly said I was going to do. A lot of people say, oh, they want to become a counselor and they want to work in a treatment center, or they want to help other people. There was never really anything I wanted to do. It happened by accident. And I realized that I was good at it and that I got something out of it as well. And that, I think, has been the biggest shift for me, is to stay focused in that area, to stay working with other people. It certainly helps me a huge amount. It keeps me aware. It keeps me – I can't forget where I come from. I think that's my biggest change. But along with that has come relationships. I was very scared of intimacy. I was very scared of, commitment. I hated myself, so why would anyone else –
exactly.
Love me.
How can anyone love you?
Exactly. Whereas I'm married now, and I never wanted children because I thought I don't want anyone growing up like me. Whereas I have three wonderful children now, and they're young, and their lives, and I can teach them so much, and I can give them so many tools, and whatever happens, I can be there for them. So those shifts, those are the things that have happened in recovery that has made my life completely different. Completely, completely different. It's not even the same anymore.
Cool. And it's also good because the addict focuses so much on himself. Now you've got other people to focus on.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So tell us a bit about your center. Let's punt it a bit.
I deal predominantly with addiction. That's kind of where my focus is. We run an outpatient treatment center, but we are focused very heavily on aftercare. One of the things I found for myself is that, going into a treatment center for 30 days or 6 weeks, and it just wasn't enough. Like I explained to you before, like it took me 4 months before I made that breakthrough.
Yes.
And for me, we looked a lot at what overseas and what international stuff is doing, and that extended care is what is vital. So we run a lengthy program, up to 6 months.
Wow.
Which is, it's only three times a week, but it's that long term kind of reinforcement, and the same things happen. People, it takes 2-3 months before the brain clears from the substances, and then things start to make sense all of a sudden. So we do things a bit different. We're very focused on the long-term aspect of it. Again, the thing that I learned from my counselor was love and compassion. My patients are also, they're my clients, and I don't believe in putting people down, and we're there to help and build and grow them. One of the big things I've always said is that you don't have to tell me what a bad person I am. I do a pretty good job of that myself. So that route has never worked, in my opinion. Whereas if I can help someone see the truth and the reality, hopefully they can make a choice to get better, and then everything opens up. So that's kind of who we are, and we're a little bit different.
Very cool.
to a lot of places. And as I say, we work on the highest international standards, stuff that is coming out now from the US. So we're constantly adapting and changing. And we work with families as well.
That's important.
Because they bear such a brunt of, especially with addiction, but also with the mental health side of things, you know, not knowing how to deal with stuff properly. What are they doing in certain situations? What is the right thing and the wrong thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly things that you can do as a family.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them might be quite hard, but just that peace of mind and having a professional to be there and bounce stuff off of. And so the family thinks they are not the ones going completely insane.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's what we do as a center and where we are focused.
It's very cool. But also what I found that you've had the addict or the suicidal patient, you treat him and then you put him back into that bad environment. So the family should be treated anyway.
Exactly, you know, I think that's one of the critical things, and it's so sad. I see it day in and day out where the family is not interested. They want to see our client get better and expect everything just to get better. And, you know, when you're talking about mental health, addiction, all of these things, these are lifelong journeys. No one is better overnight, and the family needs to get better too. They need to know how to deal with it appropriately. And it's the saddest thing that I see, because we can work with someone for so long and then it's back into that same environment and it's like everything just reverses. And it's scary. And I think it's a lot to do with the misunderstanding about what mental health disorders are as well as what addiction is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are not bad people.
No.
They're really not. And yes, they do. I'm not saying, especially addicts do terrible things. But if we can begin to understand how and why that happens, then hopefully we can move out of that. And they don't have to do those things anymore.
So what is the name of your center, Brendan?
It's the Moon Addiction Recovery Center.
That's awesome name. Why?
Again, when I started doing the research into a lot of the stuff from overseas, we started as a halfway house initially. And in my own recovery and in my clients at that stage, I started to see patterns.
Mm.
And I've always suspected this, that addicts go through phases. Just like the moon does. And these phases are predictable.
Mm-hmm.
Not exact, but they're certainly predictable. And if we can be aware of what recovery takes years and years, if we can be aware of the phases, it takes away so much of the surprise, so much of the fear out of it for family and for the addict. And that's pretty much why, you know, the and as well as the fact that, you know, the moon is a shining light in darkness. It's certainly something that guides us and it is there.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Wow, beautiful name.
Thank you.
Brendan, what advice would you give suicidal, because this is a suicidal program, but even addicts? What advice would you give someone who's that, or cutting themselves or thinking those thoughts that are just ruminating in their minds all the time? How do they get out of this? What do they do?
Personally, the only way that I believe in through my experience is to get help, to get the right people to help you, because that was my biggest thing. I carried that shame and that guilt for years. I thought I was different.
Mm-hmm.
I thought no one would understand. I thought that I was the only one that thought like this. And that did these things. And I thought that there wasn't a different way to live my life. I didn't know.
Mm.
And, you know, when I eventually got honest and told other people what was really happening, I realized that there was a lot of other people like me.
Mm.
And that fact was probably the most comforting fact I ever experienced. I thought I was alone on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And when I realized that there were other people and they were successfully getting through this, that changed everything for me. So for me, it's about speak up and speak up to the right people. You know, maybe family members aren't the right people. Maybe it's about doing a bit of research of your own.
Mm.
Maybe it's a friend you can trust. Maybe, you know, find the right person, someone you know that you, if you think you can trust them, you probably can. So find that person and just, like, it's not what you think it is. Like, you don't have to keep doing that. Mm. And you don't keep having to live that secret, that lie, that, you know, that hatred of yourself. There is a way out of it. And that was the biggest thing for me. Thinking I was going to live a life of cutting drugs, alcohol, suicide attempts, you know, waking up and being so angry from not being dead. But, I mean, angry at everyone, angry at the world, angry at myself, angry. You know, I gave up any thought of spirituality, of belief in anything. And it didn't have to be like that. It really. And if I'd spoken up sooner, things could have maybe been very different for me. Not to say that my experience hasn't taught me well. It certainly has, but I could have also, you know, succeeded where I didn't. Thank goodness.
Mm.
So find the right people. That's the most important thing.
And how do you become honest?
I think the first part of the honesty is, if we're talking about cutting and about drugs, is realizing that behavior or those actions they're not working for you.
Okay.
You know? They may have at a certain period in time. They certainly will have. For me, they did. But that they're not working anymore. I think that for cutting and for addiction, that's certainly the first part of the honesty, and then get the help. In terms of suicide, I think it's maybe you need to ask for the help first. Let someone else help you see. Because once you get to that suicide place, like I got that, there was no ways I was going to get myself out of that.
There's no ways.
Just do it and see where it goes and take the risk. You know, you're prepared to risk taking life. Maybe take the risk to save it. See what happens.
And you, because you did that
eventually. I did, eventually. And that was exactly what I had to do. I had to ask for help. And I sat there and I just said, I can't do this anymore. You know, the failed suicide attempts just led to more shame, more guilt, led to more cutting, led to more drugs, led to more alcohol, led to, you know, broken relationships, led to more shame. And it was just this continual cycle of things getting worse and worse. And as much as I blamed everybody else for that, like, there were times when I started to see that maybe I have a part in this. I would try to put those away. and that's denial. You know, pretend it didn't exist and it's not me and it's, you know, there's everybody else. But there were moments of clarity. There really were. There always were moments of clarity. And I think if you're going to be honest, like, grab onto that moment of clarity, write it down somewhere and have it as something. Because they do stand out. I remember them clearly, clearly.
And the denial, is there any way that anybody would get out of that?
I don't think you can really get out of denial on your own. You know, and I think that's why the key is asking for help in whatever form it is. Because, you know, my belief is denial can, in the initial stages, can only be broken with the help of professionals. Certainly not with your family, because they don't know how to confront denial properly. They may have denial of their own in all of it. And so third parties and you know, again, one of the best ways, yes, therapy is certainly, but support groups help with that. Because when you see people break, you know, who have broken through their denial, who are the same as you, and you can sit and go, I did that. Yes, I thought like that.
Wow.
You know, that helps you with your denial to a huge degree. So support groups and with therapy is the key. Just knowing I'm not alone and is the most important thing, because I used to feel so lonely.
Mm-hmm.
Like I really did. I felt like I was the only person on the planet. And especially the only person going through what I was going through. Yeah.
What about advice to parents and family? Because a lot of times families will sit in denial. They don't really like you. You were hiding the cutting. They don't even know about it. But surely they would pick up changes of behavior.
Absolutely. You know, I think what happened in my family, and again, I can just talk from my experiences, but, you know, my family picked up a change in behavior. It was a huge change in behavior.
Mm.
My anger and my resentment, my acting out and, bunking school and doing all of that kind of stuff was drastic.
Mm.
And it's not to blame my parents, because I don't blame my parents at all. But my mom has often said, we should have taken you to see someone then.
Mm-hmm.
We always thought. And I know that her advice would be, if you see something, like, do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to live in a world where maybe it'll get better.
Yes.
Maybe it's just a phase. Maybe it'll work itself out. Maybe it's just being a teenager. I work with addicts predominantly. But the parallel is the same, where, you know, does your child need to be in a box before you wake up?
Mm.
You know, do you want to then be saying we should have done something earlier? And it's not about breaking your child's trust, or it's about helping them and getting the right help. Do the research.
Mm.
Like, find the right places that can help, the right people, the right therapists that deal with stuff. And at least you're doing your part.
Mm.
Like, don't have regrets. Don't have regrets afterwards, because that I can, having children of my own, I think that must be the worst feeling afterwards, and saying, but I saw something was wrong and I did nothing about it, because the world has changed. Children are different now. They experience far more pressure.
Mm.
You know, they experience, technology has changed the way people connect. I use that word loosely because I don't know if they're really connecting. but the way they communicate. Mm. And that has an impact on who we are as human beings. So if there's the slightest of doubt, you know, do something about it. If there's nothing there, well, you haven't lost anyone yet, have you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just one more question, Brendan. I know December's known to be like a terrible time of the year for suicides, increased suicides. Would there be anything that you can, any advice you can give someone out there that's looking and saying, you know, it's supposed to be a time of happiness and connection, and I'm just feeling like I'm in this black hole and I could end it all?
Yeah, I mean, I used to remember, I used to drink and use a lot heavier around about this time to deal with that feeling. And there was actually, I attempted once around this period. You know, again, like first of all, try get help if that's not if that's not going to happen. Like, Christmas is a day. This is a few weeks. Like, it will come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that feeling will go away. I'd like really try and do something about it, but it doesn't last. It doesn't last forever, and it's just a day. It's just, you know. No different time to any other day or time of year, really. And then, I don't know how much that's going to work, but I tell myself that now as a tool.
Mm.
Personally, try get the help instead, or get to a support group. There's no shame in walking. Those people will open their doors to you. You'll be surprised at how they will welcome you. People who are the same as you are struggling through the same things, especially over this period.
Mm.
Try get help.
Okay, because I think shame is huge. I mean, if you speak to people and they have a family member that's attempted suicide or committed suicide, they always deny it and tell them some other angle, some other story about maybe he's died of a heart attack or whatever.
Absolutely.
So the shame within society regarding suicide is huge.
Massive.
So how do you get over that?
Again, I think that comes around being like with like-minded people through support groups. Because when you sit in a group where other people have experienced not just the same thoughts and that, but experienced the same shame. And when you know, shame gets broken when you start talking about it and when you're not being judged. And the best people to do that really are support groups, because there's someone who's having the same thoughts. And you end up having a laugh about it, which, I mean, it sounds quite absurd and bizarre in its own way, but that's a healthy coping mechanism, do you know what I mean? Talk about it, laugh about it, look at the insanity of what you're going through. And have someone to lean on when that stuff comes back, and who's not going to say, "Well, you shouldn't be doing that." Who says, "I get it, I understand. Let's hook up. Let's work through this together." It alleviates the societal perception, because you're not relying on what society thinks. You're listening to reality of people who are there, and I think that's key for me as well. I'm not the only one. Shame breeds. When I'm on my own, I can twist the smallest thing into shame, and then it just becomes a breeding ground, and it grows exponentially. But the minute I'm talking about it with someone who's not judging me, it goes.
So it's no judgment and connection, probably the bottom line.
Absolutely.
Very cool. Please give us your website again. If someone's interested.
Cool, thank you. It's www.themoonrecovery.com.
What would you like to tell us as a final?
As a final
closing remark.
Closing remark. Sure, put me on the spot there. Life's worth it.
Okay.
That's it. It really is.
That's actually very cool. That's a brilliant way to end this. Thank you so much, Brendan.
It's a pleasure.
It's been awesome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll chat soon. And I trust that lots of people will go and see your website.
Great.
And, I don't know, give you some donations or whatever it is you need.
Cool. Even if it's just a chat and drop us a line. And if there's anyone out that needs help,
what's your email address? Quick one.
It's brendan@themoonrecovery.com.
Okay, so if anyone needs help or if anyone's suicidal during this time, they just drop you a line.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Cool. Pleasure.
Thanks, Brendan. Bye.
Thank you, Brendan, for that. That was very enlightening and very poignant in many aspects, specifically how, again, Brendan feels so dark, desolate, and this intense anger he feels, which probably leads and forces his self-cutting behavior. And the reason he feels that anger is probably because of his unconscious realization of the abuse that he experienced early on in his life. Possibly a warning for parents at this point is watch out for your children's behavior. Watch them. Watch them when their behavior changes, because there is something happening. And it's so easy for us as parents to deny it and to say, you know what, everything's cool. It's a phase, like you said, but check it out. And if it is a phase, fine. But what if it isn't? And a lot of times we don't know what happens to our children and we don't know what they're experiencing. An interesting thing with the self-cutting is how he hides it so well. And I recall a time when there was a young teenager within the family. And if I think back, she always used to wear long tops and covered her body, even when it was really hot outside. And sometimes we just take things for granted and we don't question. We don't question and ask, why is she doing that? It's so hot outside. Why would she do that? And later on, I found out through a mutual friend that she was cutting herself. I don't know what happened to that teenager. She's probably a bit older now. And I just hope she found the help that she could, because that's huge. And you don't know where it can lead from there. That self-hatred is so intense. And another thing as well is the conflict. The conflict within the individual, where live, die, live, die, live, die. And even that causes the depression and such intense pain. So what I'm saying out there is ask for help. There's no shame in asking for help. So do that. It can be worth so much and it can save a life. And parents, be vigilant of your children. Another very interesting thing, afterwards Brendan and I chatted, and he was saying how people judge, we as society judge people who are addicts or who are suicidal and point fingers and shame them. And he was saying that, you know, we feel so badly about ourselves that nobody can make us feel worse than we already do feel about ourselves. So by judging us, we just get caught more and more into that cycle, and just the pain is so intensified that you just go back and self-abuse and try and commit suicide because of that intense hatred of self and shame and hatred from society. So possibly one thing that we should be doing at this point is actually giving love and compassion to these people, because with the love and compassion, we give them a space to grow and learn and move out of this intense cycle of hatred. So love, compassion, understanding, acceptance. In a society, it's very difficult, but perhaps we as people need to start understanding and learning, accepting people for who they are. So thank you for that, Brendan. That was a very enlightening and very cool interview. But also one more thing I'd like to just reiterate is that he got out of it. So now his life has turned around because he had the courage to ask for help. And he's a father. He's a very happy married man. And to see him is like an incredible thing, because he's come out and he's grown and he's helping other people. So congratulations for that, Brendan, and we wish you all the luck in your life, and we support you in helping others to get to this point again as well.
By the way, Brendan's wife, Ilani Richardson, was my guest last week. I interviewed her on addiction and how she had this triumphant recovery, got through a really traumatic life, and survived and succeeded and triumphed over all her obstacles. With that, she met Brendan, and now they are really happily married in almost an idyllic lifestyle. So I did interview her on addiction. So if you'd like to listen to that episode, you can find it on facebook.com/coachonfireradio. Go and listen to Ilani. It's a very, very exciting story. She triumphed and survived. So with that, there's hope for everybody, and just go out and ask for help.
As you recall, Brendan, the last thing Brendan did say was, remember, life is wonderful. So that's where I would like to just turn the conversation to that exact thing. I'd like to play a clip from a movie called It's a Wonderful Life. I'm going to play the clip and then we'll discuss it from there. Listen to this.
I'm worth more dead than alive.
Now, look, you mustn't talk like that. I won't get my wings with that attitude. You just don't know all that you've done. If it hadn't been for you...
Yeah, if it hadn't been for me, everybody would be a lot better off. My wife and my kids and my friends. Look, little fella, why you go off and haunt somebody else?
No, now you don't understand. I got my job.
Oh, shut up, will you?
Oh, this isn't going to be so easy.
Yeah, so you still think killing yourself would make everyone feel happier, right?
Oh, I don't know. I guess you're right. I suppose it would have been better if I'd never been born at all.
What'd you say?
I said I wish I'd never been born.
Okay, that's from a movie called A Wonderful Life. It's about, if anyone hasn't seen it, it's about someone who helps people get loans in a bank. And anyway, long story short, at the end, it blows up in his face and he just feels like it's the end of the world and he needs to just, if it wasn't for him, or he shouldn't be alive. You'll see there's an angel who speaks to him and says, okay, life is wonderful. Sit back, and I think that everyone impacts someone in their lives, or we impact people continually. In this clip at the end, the angel shows him how life would be, or how everyone's life would be without him, and he really does make a difference. So people within this mind frame, or this deep depression, or this dark hole, feel like they're useless and worthless, and life would be better without them. But in true essence, it's not so. So perhaps people feeling this deep depression should look around and see how they have impacted other people's lives at some point. Even if they think it's a bad thing, it possibly isn't. This man here made a huge difference in so many people's lives. And perhaps it would be a lesson right now, is sit back and just make notes. Take notes of who you've impacted, what you've done, and see that your life is worth something. And you as a person make an impact on the world. Change the world, and even if it's in your own little way, or so you think. Just sit back, think about it, even in your darkness, and write it down. Write down and look around you, and you'll see that you have made a difference. That's my first request to you today. Okay, so, well, if you'd like more information on the show, and motivational videos, which you probably would need at this point, and your own and our very own self-development assessments, visit our website at www.withintent.co.za. Possibly the next thing I'd like to discuss is there is hope. We could look around and we could make a difference, and we could prevent this at some point, or help someone in that darkness and let them see a bit of light. They found that serotonin, we discussed that serotonin is a neurotransmitter within the brain, and when comparing suicidal brains, research has shown, when comparing suicidal brains post-mortem and people that have died from natural causes, the serotonin is quite depleted within the suicidal brain. And serotonin is a feel-good neurotransmitter. So it changes and shifts the mood within the individual. So if you have a low serotonin level, it does affect moods. It brings on depression and all those kind of things. But what are you going to do about it? How can you make a difference, and how can you change that the serotonin levels within your brain? So research has shown that possibly you could have dietary factors also influence your brain chemistry, and you'd look at possibly one of the most important things within the brain is the vitamin B complex, which it's been research has shown that vitamin B's affect the nervous system in a positive way. So if you are taking in those vitamins, obviously it would affect your chemistry and affect your mood. But you need to go and get advice and just go, and because you can overdose on it if you take too much. So go in and get professional advice for the vitamin B. Another interesting food that makes a huge difference, and research has shown this, is dark chocolate. And if most of us just love chocolate. I am a chocolate freak. I love chocolate. So this is a very good thing for me, because you can just go out and enjoy chocolate and have your mood changed. I'm sure people have gone out and you can prove it for yourself. Many people are chocolate geeks out there. But specifically, there's something within the dark chocolate that it's been proved that changes the mood. And then green tea. Green tea is a very interesting substance. The Chinese have been drinking it for centuries, eons. And it's not only a lifter, it also is a good, it increases antioxidants within your body. So it's already a feel, it's not only a feel-good tea, but it also assists you in well-being. Green tea is a stimulant as well. So it keeps you, your mind active and alert. Should try some out and see how you feel about that. It's also found that in the UK, because of the weather, the depressed weather and cold, and in winter when it's dreary, suicide rates and depression rates increase, and that is because of the seasons. So another good thing is to increase your depressed mood is go out into the sun or bright light, and that has also been proved to just change and shift your moods. So try that one out as well. I found that when I go out into the sun and just breathe in that beautiful energy and just feel that sun on my back and my face, it changes my mood instantly. Try it out, and in fact, try it out and let me know what you feel or how you feel about this. It would be interesting to hear your remarks. Give me a call and let me know. The number is 646-716-7979. I'd really love to hear from you and hear your feelings about depression and suicide. It's a very contentious subject at the moment. Another interesting thing is, and this has been proved on numerous occasions, is exercise. When you're feeling down, take a walk. Take a walk and walk. And instead of thinking about how badly you feel, think about how beautiful your environment is. Look around. Look around and look at the flowers. Feel the grass under your feet. In fact, walk bare feet on the grass. That is incredible energy, and it will change your mood and make you feel like you're worth it, because you're on this earth for a reason. Walk around, look around, smell the fresh air, listen to the children, or just listen to the sounds of nature. That'll change your mood as well. And along with exercise, you could also do yoga, the stretching, the breathing. Breathing has an immense change in mood as well. In fact, we probably could try some breathing exercises right now. So if you're listening, stop for 1 minute. Just stop and breathe in. Stop. Breathe in for 8. So breathe in for 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Hold for 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And then breathe out for 8. If you do that 3, 4, 5 times, that also will change the energy within your body, and you'll feel lighter and more at peace with who you are. And you can also think clearly and see where you're at so that you can realize that you need to ask for help. Just ask for help. Ask someone to help you if you feel the need to end it all. There's always someone out there to help you, and you'll always know where to go. There's support groups. Ask for help from support groups, because they are non-judgmental. They won't judge you because they've been there. They understand. So if you go out and find like-minded people, they can help you. Another interesting thing is random acts of kindness. If you go out and being in this kind of space, you're so self-involved, you become so caught up in your own self that the world outside doesn't count for anything. If you can go out and help someone else, you can see that there are other people that are worse off than you. There are other people that need help just like you do. So if you go out and help somebody, buy them a cup of coffee, or probably the best thing to do is just smile at someone. And that's very hard when you're feeling depressed. So try that out, even if it's just one smile. And it works baby steps. It works slowly. And one smile at one person and they smile back, you can already have made a difference in their lives and realize how impactful your life really is. You are worth it. You just need to realize that. My very, very favorite thing in the world, treatment for anything or prevention for anything, would be laughter. Listen to this clip.
Sure. Just as I said. What is this all about?
What's the matter with you?
I'm out all day long looking around for work. Do you ever go out and look for work?
Well, certainly I was.
Am here. I the only one who's going to do all the work around here?
I was working. I was reading a comic book.
Reading a comic book? That don't feed you, my friend.
Hey, wait a minute.
That don't put food in the icebox.
Wait a minute.
Don't give me that wait a minute stuff.
Yeah, but I think I heard something I don't know.
Why?
Did you say you were out all day working?
I was out there looking for a job.
Did you get it?
Yes, I got a job.
Well, good.
I had to get a job. You don't want to work.
What are you doing?
I got a job in a bakery.
Good. What are you doing there?
Loafing.
That's just...
What
are you doing?
Loafing.
Where?
In a bakery.
You working?
Certainly.
Doing what?
Loafing.
Well, that's what I was doing here. I was just taking it easy. I was
loafing. No. That kind of loafing. You're just a lazy idiot. Not this here kind here.
I was taking it easy, same as you.
I work when I loaf.
How can you work and loaf at the same time?
Why not?
Can you do that?
That's what they pay me for.
They pay you for what?
To loaf.
How would I pay you for loafing? You're in a baker, so you gotta do something.
I'm in a baker, so I'm loafing there.
You just go to the work in the baker store, you don't do a thing.
And oh, yes, yes.
How much they pay in a baker store for loafing?
$1.50 an hour.
For loafing?
You're a union man. I belong to the union.
I'm loafing here and getting a nickel for it.
Well, you're not supposed to get any money for that kind of loafing.
Well, can I loaf there, would you?
I should say not. You've got to join a union.
I got to join a union of loafers?
You can't loaf without belonging to the union.
Well, what do you think of that? Well, you mean I got to join a union in order to loaf?
Well, certainly.
I don't see nothing, but I was loafing here without the union.
No, you aren't loafing here. You can't loaf here. You can't loaf here. You got no dough.
I got no dough. That's why I'm loafing, because I got no dough.
Oh, no. If you had dough, you could loaf. But then you'd have to get a card and join the union.
You mean you got to have dough to loaf?
Oh, sure. How can you loaf without dough?
That's very hard. I've been trying it. You can't do it, Sammy.
You can't do anything.
I can't retire right now. I gotta have a job.
Someday, come down to the bakery. I'll show you how to loaf. I do real loafing. In fact, you know, I never told you this. My whole family were loafers.
No kidding.
Sure. My father was a bigger loafer than me.
He was?
Yeah, he was one of the best loafers in the family.
I think you're a better loafer than your father.
Oh, I know that now, because he taught me how to loaf.
You know you're a bigger loafer than your father.
Right? Oh, sure, sure.
You're a bigger loafer than me, too, ain't you?
Well, you're no loafer.
I'm not.
No, certainly not.
But you are.
You're just a lazy, no good for nothing, whatever you
call. How can I be lazy? crazy. You just told me I'm no loafer. You're a loafer, not me.
But I get paid for loafing. You don't.
That's what I don't understand. Working in a bakery store, I'm getting paid $1.50 an hour for loafing.
That's right.
This, I don't understand.
You don't understand? What is there to understand?
I don't understand you working and loafing and getting paid for it.
Wait a minute.
Can I get a job there? Do the same? No, I can't get a job there.
That's what belongs to the union.
All you do is talk, and that's all I hear. You don't say nothing, loafing.
I don't say anything.
No.
Look, you go to the union. You get a card. You go to the bakery. They give you dough. You need the dough first.
I need the dough, and how I need the dough? We need dough.
I need the dough in order to loaf.
I need the dough in order to loaf. Well, give me some dough, and I'll get something to eat in the
you
joint.
You can't get any dough. You
poor
can't
Bingo. I don't know what I'm going to do. He's going to look for other parents. Leave me.
Wait a minute.
I want to ask you just one thing.
What?
What makes a balloon go up?
Hot air.
What's holding you down? I pulled a joke.
Now, just a minute. Get your coat. Go ahead. Get your coat. I'll take you one. I'll get you a job someplace.
Okay, you heard that. That was very funny. Possibly one of the best preventions for suicide is laughing therapy. So find out. Go and find something to laugh at. Or maybe laugh at yourself. We as people, as individuals, take ourselves too seriously. We should be looking at ourselves and laughing, because life is wonderful, but it's transient and it's short, and laughing will do us good. So one of my best quotes for today is that go out, laugh at yourself, find something to laugh at, or just giggle and laugh and try it. And of course, I could say that if you're down and you're dark and you're desolate and you're depressed, it's very difficult. But if you just take one little step and try it and listen to this clip again, and you'll see that it's very funny. And even if you just giggle for one little bit, you can change that energy and possibly change your life or help someone else to do the same. I think we've come to the end of our show. I hope you've really, really enjoyed it. Before I leave you, I would like you to direct you back to our website once more, because we have a laughing video there as well, motivational video. Go and watch it. It's actually quite amusing. And that will assist you in starting your laughing therapy. Okay, so if you would like to learn more about us and our show, please go to our website. It's www.withintent.co.za. We have some really, really cool, really, really cool assessments, self-development assessments. Those are free, so go and try them out. You'll be able to assess yourself and learn a bit about yourself and then be able to move on from there, which is very cool. We also have motivational videos. Those are our own motivational videos. Got a very cool laughing video, so go out, check that one out. That'll be very good for you, and you can then start your laughing therapy on that, with that video. So I'm saying thank you so much for listening. Our next show is going to be on healing. I'm going to be doing a remote healing somebody, and I'm looking for a volunteer. So if anybody's out there that would like to volunteer for this process, drop me a line. My website is Karina, Carina, at withintent.co.za. Drop me drop me a line. That's very cool. Remember, life is worth it. And remember, you are awesome. Thank you for listening, and we'll chat soon.
I can do anything, I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want, I can be what I want to be.
Coach on Fire Radio.